Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. She's the most famous woman in the world, so famous, in fact, that 9 million people visit her every year. The Mona Lisa also may be the most famous painting in art history, but the story behind the real Lisa has remained something of a mystery. Joining us now is the author of a new book on the topic, Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. Diane Hales, welcome to the show.
I'm so happy to join you.
So Mona Lisa was a real person. You didn't even think about her in those terms, though, before you decided to write this book.
Well, no, not at all. I had been to the Louvre, and I had trekked up the stairs, and I stood in front of the painting and took it in, and it didn't even occur to me that that this was someone who had a name and a life. And I started studying Italian many years ago, and then around 7 or 8 years ago, I started writing a book, a sort of biography on Italian called The Bella Lingua, and so I was spending a lot of time in Florence. And that was when there was quite a bit of research going on about the real Mona Lisa, and by coincidence, I was having dinner with the woman who said, do you know that the woman, La Gioconda, they call her in Italy, in the painting, her mother grew up in this palazzo. And I was so stunned by the fact that really, you know, that wasn't just sort of a figment of Leonardo's wonderful imagination. This was somebody who had a name, and I discovered had a house and a dress and a baptismal record and a death certificate. This was a real woman, una donna vera, they say in Italian.
So then why all the conspiracy theories over the years, or all of the other theories otherwise to the other?
Well, it's first of all, there's Leonardo himself, who is I guess you could say that he's a cult figure, and that almost anything connected to him has stirred controversy and discussion. But I think that, well, several things about it. It was documented in the very first work of art history by Giorgio Vasari. He wrote that this was a portrait of the wife of Francesco del Giocondo, and people accepted that for centuries. But the painting, Leonardo's final patron was King Francis I. And so Leonardo spent his final years in France. And so the painting was the property of the French royalty. And not many people saw it, not many people discussed it. And so no one was even thinking about its identity. And it wasn't until after the French Revolution and after Napoleon, who loved it so much that he had it in his bedroom, that the public, the people, began to see this painting. And the Romantics chose to fall in love with it and wrote poems about it and brought flowers to it. And the idea that it could be like, that's when I think the idea of a real woman got lost, because she wasn't a real woman. She was the ultimate woman, the femme fatale and the sphinx of beauty. They just went on and on about it. And then the painting was stolen in 1911. And that's when people who had never heard of the Mona Lisa were nonetheless obsessed with finding that she was the world's first tabloid celebrity. Where is the Mona Lisa? And there were sightings everywhere. And so from that moment on, the painting became famous for being famous, and the idea of who was in it got lost until really around 10, 15 years ago, when archivists started coming across records documenting her life. And so it's been little pieces of the puzzle coming together more and more. And then in 2005, a library researcher found a book that dates back to the Renaissance, and it was a book that was talking about a Greek artist from ancient Greece, and it talked about how he used the same technique in the sense of first painting the features of a face and then finishing up. That was being used by Leonardo da Vinci in his portrait of Lisa Gherardini, which was commissioned by her husband Francesco del Giocondo. And so we now had this document, but it really, that's 10 years ago, so I think that that's why, in the absence of that document, in the absence of proven fact, the theories just multiplied and multiplied. And they also got more and more out. At first, it was just who else was alive at that day? Lucrezia Borgia. Oh, must be of Lucrezia Borgia. Must be of a Medici mistress. It must be this person. But this is the only documented evidence. And I think there's a little bit of Some feel that there's more mystery, you know, that it adds to the painting to just have all the conspiracy about it. But I personally feel that it adds, for me, now when I look at the Mona Lisa, I see this beautiful painting, I see this masterpiece, but I also see a woman. I see a daughter of Florence, I see a mother, a wife. And that has immensely deepened my appreciation of the painting.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Mona Lisa, the subject of the portrait by Leonardo da Vinci, with Diane Hales. She's the author of a new book. It's called Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. If you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. It would be fun to hear from listeners who have seen the Mona Lisa call and tell us what their impressions were of the painting. All that it's cracked up to be, maybe not so much, maybe it was just too long of a line. Who knows? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You wove many of your experiences investigating this topic into the content of the book. It was personal for you. One of the aspects of that was the actual famous smile, Mona Lisa's smile, that you tried to capture and understand more about over time.
Well, it certainly yes, and there what I discovered is that more than anything else is what has captivated the imagination, and it's some people. Some people have debated whether it's not, you know, this big grin. That's for sure. It's just sort of a cusp of a smile, and I think that's what makes the painting so alive. And what was interesting is that whenever it depended on everyone can look at this smile from very different perspectives. Art historians see it basically as a breakthrough in painting. Until that time, artists really couldn't capture when they tried to portray a grin. It ended up looking like a grimace, and so. Leonardo was the first to sort of be able to soften, and it's not just in his other paintings you see similar smiles. So this was sort of a technical achievement. But then you have what Leonardo was also trying to do much more so. He was leap years ahead, just huge advances ahead of everyone else. He was trying to capture a real person, and so in doing that, there's the look in Mona Lisa's eye. There's this hint of a smile, and it's that centuries before photography, he really captured that sort of immediacy. And so there is that sense of somebody who's about to smile more. And I think that adds to its charm. Modern scientists have looked at it through all sorts of imaging techniques and have there's an optical theory about, well, if you look at it from the side, it's more like a smile. If you look at it straight on, it doesn't seem like so much of a smile. The question of why she is smiling has also been addressed in the first report on it. Vasari said that Leonardo was trying to avoid that gloomy look that comes over people in portraits, and so he brought in entertainers and musicians and was consciously trying to make her smile. Most of the art historians I talk to are very dubious about that. They think that's a little bit much. But my own feeling is when I went, you talk about why I brought in the personal aspects of it, is that I had done a lot of research online. I had done a lot of, certainly read my way through a library of books. But it wasn't until I went to Florence and I actually saw what a small space we are talking about. As I said, I was in this house where Mona Lisa's mother grew up. Well, it was 30 yards, from the house where Leonardo's father lived. Now, Leonardo had grown up and was living in Milan, but still, this is how close they were. And my sense is that Leonardo, certainly his father, knew Lisa's family. He did business with Lisa's husband. That this was not a complete stranger, and that Leonardo at the time had moved from Milan. He needed work. He needed money. He needed the commission. But he had other offers, and he could have, that were more prestigious and might have turned out to be more lucrative. There must have been something about Lisa herself. And when I went into her family history, I found that the Gherardini were an ancient clan, and they have wonderful legends that date back to ancient Rome. And then they were in Florence from the 10th century, and they were knights, and they were robber barons, and they were rebels, and some of them were beheaded. But above all, they were proud. They just were so fiercely independent, and no one messed with them. And I think that Lisa had a certain spirit, that something in her blood, and that the smile, that which is a brazen thing. Renaissance women were supposed to keep their eyes down; they weren't supposed to look directly at anyone. And here you have Mona Lisa looking at us, looking at Leonardo, looking at everyone who is going to behold the painting, and with that sort of knowing smile. So I think there was something in Lisa and that's what captivates her. It's like, this is the woman who thinks, this is the woman who feels, this is the woman I'd like to know.
Deb in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Deb. You've seen Mona Lisa?
Hi, yeah. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to give a quick comment that, yes, I went to see it a few years ago. I went with my mom, and we were actually both, honestly, very disappointed. We, I guess we just had this big, you know, grander of an idea of how it was going to be. And it was just such a tiny painting, and we had to wait in line for so long. And then the room was huge, and you had to kind of, you know, fight your way to the front to see this really tiny painting. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it was just kind of a disappointment. And, that was really all I had to, you know.
No, that's okay. I think it brings up an interesting point. Thanks a lot, Deb.
Yes, thank you.
Yep. Yeah, I've never seen it in person, but I do know that the size, actual size of the painting isn't what we imagine. It's such a hugely famous image, and yet, tell us about the dimensions of it and how it ranked in its day.
Well, at the time it was... It wasn't again. This was a painting that was created for a home. You know, it wasn't being, you know, like they're huge murals that we see that, you know, we have when we go and you go to Florence and you go into the churches and you mm-hmm. see these walls covered with frescoes. And so, you know, this is a modest size, and it's certainly, you know, smaller than 2 by 3 feet. And so it's also I personally could not say to your listeners, you've got to go to Paris and you've got to go to the Louvre, because I've seen it ranked as one of the top 10 disappointing destinations in the world. And it's part of it is just everybody else is there with you, so that they're snapping photos and they're snapping selfies. But what I would say to your listeners is go to Florence and walk her streets. And see, you know, you can go to the churches that, and this is what the adventure of my book was all about, mm-hmm. was going to Florence, and that's where she became alive to me. And so, and it's a much more satisfying experience, because it's, you're actually you're not just looking at two dimensions. You can actually kind of get this sense of a three-dimensional person. And it's a whole new way. If you've been to Florence a lot, I assure you, you have never been to Via Squadra, which is this dank little lane where she was born, or to the convent where she died, or to the street where she lived. And so I think that the painting, and when you look at it, the thing is, the more I learned about it, the more I appreciated it, you know, the more, there are tens of thousands of brush strokes on this smallish painting, and yet you do not see a single one. That's how smooth the surface is. So that Leonardo had perfected this technique of teeny tiny brush strokes, and then he used these glazes, and he put the glazes on one upon another, and he kept working on it. He started the painting in 1503, and he never delivered it. He always thought when he had to leave Florence, he was summoned to Milan. He considered it unfinished and took it with him, and so he continued to perfect it, to add to it throughout his life. And so I think it became more special to him, and that the intricacies, the delicacies, and I learned more about it by seeing there are these huge books that have X-ray images of it and digitalized images of it, and then when you see those, you kind of can appreciate his technique. But the viewing experience at the Louvre, I think, has actually gotten worse rather than better over the years. I first saw it more than 30 years ago, when you could actually go and have a moment. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's possible anymore.
My guest is Diane Hales. She's the author of Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Diane Hales, author of Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. That's what we're talking about this hour, the Mona Lisa, the portrait by Leonardo da Vinci. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You mentioned the word, the idea of the snapshot, Diane. Ironically, it was anything but, as you said. He spent years working on it. How do we even know? Is there a way to know if that's what Mona Lisa, if that's what Lisa Giardelli really looked like? Giardini, sorry.
That's a fascinating question. And one of the things that I think, and there's among the many conspiracy theories, this is not that much, there's what's called the earlier version. And there were copies made, many copies, right from the beginning. They were probably people, painters copying the portrait as Leonardo was working on it. But that there's either a very good copy or what its owners, a bunch of Swiss investors, have a painting in a bank vault in Switzerland that they say is also Lisa Gherardini, but she looks much younger. And they've invested millions in trying to confirm that this is a Leonardo. And I can't comment. I really, you know, the art world has yet to decide, and all the art experts. But what's so intriguing about it is that it really does. When you put the two paintings side by side, you see a younger face and you see a more mature face, and so it's an intriguing idea. But what I've wondered about is that, all right, the painting started when Lisa was around 24, and then he continued working on it until she was probably well into her 30s. If she had ever seen the painting that hung in the Louvre, how we feel when we see a painting of ourselves in our youth, and you know, you kind of recognize the girl you used to be, and then you think, oh my God, I have changed. It would have been We don't know what Lisa herself would have made of it. And it probably, some people, and I agree with the art historians who think that as Leonardo worked on this painting, he must have added to it his insights into mm-hmm. life, his life lessons, so that this is probably a wiser, a deeper, he added more dimensions to her. So, and when you see this, I'm so intrigued by this earlier version, because you do see that a freshness, a sort of a simpler girl. And then when you look at the Mona Lisa and look at it very carefully, you do see a more mature a woman. And at that time, she would have had, at the time that the portrait was done, she already had given birth to 5 children, and one of them had died at age 2. So this is not just a callow girl. You know, this is somebody who has had a lot of life experience.
David in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. I saw the Mona Lisa a number of years ago, and I think the advantage in my viewing was, at the time I had foreign press credentials, and for some reason they thought that was, although they weren't in art, but they let me in right away. So I was able to go right to it, and there was a decent crowd, but it wasn't overwhelming, kind of an odd time of day. And so my experience of it was not colored by this long wait in line, which you really, I think, can kind of bring you down.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got a chance to kind of walk in, look at the painting, and I liked it quite a bit. And all the things that your guest was saying, I found there too.
So you had a moment with it then?
Yeah, I wasn't alone, but I certainly was able to walk up and take a look at it and back up and look around.
Okay.
Very nice.
All right, David, thank you so much.
Sure.
The book you wrote, Diane Hale, has also been sort of an exercise in defining the times of the woman, and you spend a lot of time doing that, and that was one of the things I found so fascinating. What were they like for someone in her position? Who was she? She wound up in a pretty prosperous household.
Yes.
Luckier than maybe many of her siblings.
Yes, luckier than most women of her time. One of the revelations for me is that, you know, we always hear about the Renaissance man, and we think what a wonderful time that would have been to live. Well, the Renaissance woman did not have it quite so good. There were really no liberation was did not exist at the time. Women had no legal rights. Basically, if you were a historian, put it that Renaissance Florence was one of the most unlucky places to be born female. And the reason is that a girl she was born into a family. Her father had complete control over what happened to her, and his mission in life was to find the best possible husband for the family. What could both advance the family in political or economic or social ways? And then she immediately passed to the control of her husband, who made all the decisions. Women couldn't own property. They couldn't go to university. They couldn't work outside the home. They couldn't travel on their own. These were not modern liberated women, but within those restrictions, women of Mona Lisa's class, which is the merchant class and above, they knew how to read. They had schooling. They learned basically a lot of domestic arts. They learned to be charming. They learned to play musical instruments, to recite poetry, to dance, most of them were married by around age 15. The idea was that you wanted to get your girl, your daughter, taken care of, kind of get that situated, but you had to provide a dowry, and that was what really attracted suitors. And the Florentines were merchants, and marriage in Renaissance Florence was basically a business deal. And you had a girl who was this lovely young virginal creature, but more importantly, bottom line was how much money came with her. The dowry was sort of seen as a down payment on a lifetime of support from her husband to be, and the men negotiated this usually usually it was the bride's father, and they looked for mature husbands, so that Mona Lisa was 15. She married a man who was about to turn 30, and that was standard. That was considered just that made sense. If a girl wasn't married by 17, she was considered a catastrophe. And then if she didn't get a suitor by the time she ended her teens, she would end up in a nunnery. It was unthinkable, unacceptable to have an unmarried woman in your household. So those were your career options, either a wife or a nun. And so Lisa, whose birth family was always strapped for money, and she had six younger siblings. So her father really did want to marry her off. And yet he didn't have a cash dowry. And but what was fortunate for him was that Francesco del Giocondo, who was a successful merchant, was a widower, and his wife had died suddenly and left him with a little boy who was only around 18 months old. So that he didn't need the money. He had but he needed a mother. He needed a mother for his son, and he needed a sort of a trophy wife. And he negotiated to get a piece of the property, of the Gherardini property. And so here Lisa, though, imagine this. She's 15 years old. She finds herself in an arranged marriage, and she goes to live not just with her husband and his son, but they lived all in the bride would enter the husband's whole family household, so that she was living with her in-laws, her mother-in-law, her father-in-law, all of Francesco's siblings, their spouses, and she was she had to join that hierarchy, and so it was a total transformation for her. It was an economic step up in the world, but I think that she lobbied very well, because by the time that Leonardo began her portrait, Francesco was buying a separate house for them, and so they eventually were able to move into their own space. And within the household, the women really they were the center of power. They everything revolved. They were the ones who reigned in the domestic arena. And I think the other way that women you could see it in their faces in the paintings. When you look at Mona Lisa, you certainly don't see a victim. You see this composed, confident, competent woman. And so even though they were not liberated in the way we think of it, I think that Renaissance women had strength and they had joy in their life, and they also had a very deep faith. Every Renaissance book I looked at that showed the home, there would always be a little altar with Mary, and Renaissance women were very devoted to Mary, who I think they prayed to desperately when they were giving birth, because that was so perilous. And I think that Mona Lisa probably became a woman of deep faith, too. She chose to enter a convent to live for the last years of her life, and she chose to be buried in one.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. How did Da Vinci and Lisa make contact?
Well, there's a wonderful church, kind of a compound in Florence, and the name of it is Santissima Annunziata. That means the Most Holy Annunciation. And there were a group of friars there, and they were very wealthy because it was considered the home of a miraculous painting. And pilgrims would come, and they would donate. They would bring all. They would basically, in gratitude, they would give gifts to the church. And the person who handled all of their business and legal affairs was Leonardo da Vinci's father. And so he was constantly there. And then the person who supplied their linens and their vestments was Lisa's husband. And we know from written records that Lisa's husband, he was not a quiet soul. He went through life basically pouncing on profits wherever he could find them. If anyone owed him money, he would pursue them through the courts. So we have a long record of this man who was boisterous and truculent, and I've been told not unlike other Florentine businessmen, but just a really aggressive, avaricious man. And so he would loan money to the friars at this church, but he would charge a very high interest rate, and they were trying to renegotiate that. So at the time of the around the 1500, you have Leonardo's father and you have Lisa's husband, and they're talking through this issue with the loan. Leonardo had been in Milan. He had to flee because the French invaded, and he comes to town and he needs a place to live. His father, Leonardo was an illegitimate child.
Right.
And his father never recognized him. So he was a grown man. He was in his 50s. He wasn't going to move into his father, who had by that time 12 other children. And so his father probably arranged for Leonardo took up residence in this same compound. He was the friars were happy to provide room and board for him and his entourage, and he in turn agreed to paint an altarpiece for the church. So all three lives convene there, and the thinking is that that perhaps Leonardo's father introduced him to Francesco as a potential patron, or their lives may have. But that's sort of the theory of it. All the timing was right and the place was right, and he would have seen Lisa, who may have come to worship in the church, and she would have. He was a rock star then. Leonardo was people, and he was no shy retiring poet. He would dress in rose and pink velvets. He wore his hair long. He was an incredibly good-looking man, and he was very tall. So that when he walked through Florence, people would rush to the window just to see to get a glimpse of him. So that she certainly was aware of the fact that this larger-than-life figure was going to paint her portrait. You know, she was not, and she may have thought, well, it's just for my husband. It's just going to be seen by my family. But she was aware of what an honor it was, that's for sure.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, and we've talked about, he didn't just sit down and paint the portrait. It took years. How did that reflect the man in the times? Was that typical, or was that Leonardo?
That was Leonardo.
Yeah.
He had a hard time finishing anything.
Yeah, did he ever finish that altarpiece?
No.
Okay. I wondered, that was one of my enduring questions to reading the book. I was like, wait a minute, whatever happened to that altarpiece? Those poor monks.
And it's and I think that's why there's such a cult of mystery about him, is that he it wasn't part of it. There are explanations for why didn't he finish things, and one was that he set such a high standard of perfection that he kept striving toward it. He wasn't willing to say that's good enough, that's done. He always wanted to continue to improve and enhance. And the other one was that his mind was just whirling. I don't know if today if we would say that he had an attention disorder, but he would be caught up in so many things at the same time that he would just move on. And so he was at the time that he was painting the Mona Lisa, he was obsessed with flight, And so here he is. He's studying birds. He's sketching birds. He's actually constructing wings. He's he's a self-taught man. He grew up in a little town. His grandparents were the ones who raised him, and so he just had a rudimentary education. He never even learned Latin, which was the language used in universities and the language of scholarship. And yet when he went to Milan and he wanted to learn, he taught himself Latin, and it's just fascinating to see him. If you took Latin, it's like amo, when you write out the verbs amo, amas, amat, and there it is in Leonardo's wonderful handwriting. And he just was so hungry for knowledge, and he studied physics, he studied mathematics, he studied optics. And I love this detail about the painting. If you look closely at it, one of Mona Lisa's pupils is just slightly more dilated than the other, because that's what happens when light brushes across your eyes. One eye, your eyes mm-hmm. don't react at the same time. And that's the kind of detail that he was going for, and that's why he would keep going back and spend all of this time. And at the end of his life, I think he sort of rued, I think, the time that was lost, and he would write in his notebook, "Tell me, was anything ever finished?" And so I think the Mona Lisa perhaps is as close to finished as just because he did have all this time for it.
And an email from Alex briefly asks, can you please describe what is in the background of the painting?
Oh, well, that could be a book in itself. It's this wonderful combination of natural forces, and you see water, you see mountains, you see a bridge. And Italians have devoted, I don't know if I could say centuries, but they've devoted a lot of time to trying to making the case that it's their bridge in their town. it's interesting because when you look at the painting, it doesn't match up. What's on the right side doesn't. You can't draw a line to the left side. So mm-hmm. that in itself makes sort of boggles the mind and the eye. The theory I believe is that it's not any one place, but that it's sort of a fantastical Tuscan landscape where you see her in nature and you see the complexity and the beauty, and yet she is, it dominates it. I mean, it's the landscape is there, and it's just it's the backdrop, and I think maybe that too adds to this sense of photography. That it's a very vivid scene, almost more vivid than life itself, and that you have this sense that here's a snapshot of a woman caught in this world. But then there are lots of theories about the symbolism. Does it contain greater meaning? Are there numbers in it? Are there letters in it? And the Louvre has really not dissected, but x-rayed and examined the painting and says there are no hidden messages. But I think Dan Brown really did more than
that. Author of the
Da Vinci Code, I think that he sort of rekindled all those frames, that there must be more to it than just a woman in a painting.
My guest is Diane Hales. She's the author of a new book. It's called Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Diane Hales, the author of the book, Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. I'd like to hear from folks who have seen the Mona Lisa. What do you think? Disappointed? Surprised? Any kind of reflection thereof? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Both of them, Leonardo da Vinci and Mona Lisa, lived, as you wrote, amid rapid change, political strife, meteoric creativity, and economic booms and busts. And the amount of creativity that was, it was almost run amok in a way. I have to admit, I like Michelangelo a bit less for reading your book, because he was mean to Leonardo da Vinci. It was amazing. Hi, Diane.
They refer to his terribilità.
What? Yeah. Well, yeah. Diane, I'm sorry. Can you start over again? I'm sorry.
Sure. Michelangelo had an incredible temper, and they called it his terribilità, his sort of terribleness. And he was the opposite. Leonardo had this sweet nature. He charmed everyone. He played the lute. He loved to mingle. Michelangelo, by comparison, was practically a hermit. He just lived with his art and just devoted himself to it. And one day these two men and Leonardo was the older, and he was already established, and Michelangelo was the upstart. And Leonardo was the painter, and Michelangelo was the sculptor. And so they both made disparaging remarks about sculpting and about painting. And so one day they were in the same piazza, and some tourists were asking some questions about a phrase in Dante. And Leonardo said, "Oh, no, you shouldn't ask me. You should ask Michelangelo." And Michelangelo, for some reason, and thought that this was an insult, and said, you who couldn't even complete this work, this giant sculpture that Leonardo had been working on." And he called the people of Milan capone, big heads, because they believed in him, and he strutted away. And so there was this great public insult, and so they had this rivalry going on, and it does, I think, reflect very poorly on Michelangelo, because it makes him just seem like he's jealous and bad tempered, and I think he was.
He was a jerk. Okay.
So. Brilliant.
Anita, in Columbus, you've been to the Louvre and Florence.
Well, geez, I didn't mean to interrupt the fascinating things your guest was talking about, Michelangelo and Leonardo. Yeah, when my twin sister and I were much younger, when we were in, so it would have been, 30 years ago, we were in high school, we had a summer in France. That's when we first saw the Mona Lisa. And as she said, it was a lot more accessible then. I was really struck with, the wisdom in her eyes. I do not know art, but I know beauty. And I thought it was beautiful. And, again, I've been to Florence, and having seen some of the places, and as you say, I haven't been to the square where she was raised, but I can see the setting, Florence, the setting. Florence is one of my very favorite places. Mm-hmm. And I can see I really can see that. But I also think that I just keep coming back to the wisdom in her eyes. It was,
yes.
I don't know art. I'm not an artist, but I appreciate it. I really was struck. I think it is an extraordinary painting.
Okay.
And that's about all I have to say.
All right, Anita, thanks a lot.
Uh-huh.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And I think that's a wonderful point, because there is that wisdom. And I think the question that could be asked, and that is that the wisdom of Mona Lisa, or is that the wisdom of Leonardo?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's also, when we see that, we read a lot of ourselves into it. If you're when I was interviewing some of the archivists who've done a lot of work digging up her family records, I said, "Well, how do you see her?" And they would say, "Oh, I see her as a mother." Never in my mind have I ever thought of Mona Lisa as a mother. I think I was young, her age when I saw her, and even now I just don't think of her as a mother. I think of her, though, as a kindred spirit and as a woman, and as not as my mother, but having the same maternal feelings that I've known in my life. So it's just interesting that there is that appreciation of wisdom, and whether it's partly hers, partly Leonardo's, and partly our own life experience that we kind of transfer to her.
Her home of Florence has all but forgotten her, right? Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think it's because it got the for one thing, the paintings in Paris,
right.
and the French have they talk about the Frenchification of the Mona Lisa, and so that France was the country that brought her to the United States, that sent her around the world. France has sort of glorified her to be a universal beauty, and so her Italianness got lost along the way. And Florence has it's more Michelangelo's town. There are only three, actually, Leonardo's that you can see in the Uffizi, and he's not much of a presence. So I think that's part of it. But what's good is that with these archival findings, again, just from the last decade, I was in Florence last year, and for the first time, her childhood neighborhood celebrated her birthday. They had Mona Lisa Lisa Day, which is on June 15th, and they had a party, and they had a little walk through her neighborhood, and they repeated it this year, and I think they are hoping that, Florence will rally around this and start reclaiming their daughter. She died, as I mentioned before, in a convent that has fallen into terrible ruin, and it's one of Florence's biggest eyesores, and so there is also a campaign to get rid of this. I mean, it's been an eyesore for decades, and to create a cultural center. And unfortunately, the Italian economy is not exactly booming, and I don't know where the money might come from. But I think that there is this sense now that something should be done, and there's a kind of ghoulish search on for her skeleton, to identify her skeleton. And I have my I'm very skeptical about it. But on the other hand, it too is getting back to the message of Lisa Gherardini was a real woman. She was a woman in Florence. Florence should, if anything good could ever come out of that, it would be if they did manage to identify her skeleton, then at least there could be some sort of proper monument. But I do think that Florence is just sort of waking up and wanting to reclaim her.
We have an email from Leslie who writes, I saw the Mona Lisa the first time when it was brought to Washington during the Kennedy administration. It was on a stage displayed on an easel and flanked by two Marine honor guards. Then I saw it when I was in Paris while in college in the 1970s. I was disappointed to find it jammed in the middle of a wall full of paintings. I could have missed it with all the other paintings around it. Now, that's not how I visualize it. I always thought it had its own place.
It does now.
Okay.
It does now. And it's the Japanese actually funded a new installation. And a lot of it has to do with security. And but it has it doesn't have its own room, but it has its own wall, and but it has bigger glass around it, and it has a railing, so that you're really actually more put off, but you're not distracted by having other paintings in the same wall.
We also have an email from Sharon who writes, seeing the Mona Lisa was an exhilarating experience. The small painting and the huge space seemed appropriate to her famous stature. What contributed to the experience was following Rick Steves' guidelines when and how to see the painting.
Well, I think that anytime you get, I think that the more informed you are, I don't know what Rick Steves is. I think wonderful and probably has very sensible guidelines. But I think it always helps. That it helps to have a sense of what you're going to see. It helps to have the background. I personally think it helps to know her life story.
Mm-hmm.
and so I think that the more informed you are as you go when you go to see the painting, the more you're going to get out of it.
I think one of the things he should suggest is booking your trip ahead of time, your
Absolutely,
visit.
Yes.
Then you get bypassed the huge lines.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would think at this time of year, more so than ever.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us about her progeny. Do they really exist?
Well, her two daughters she ended up in convents, but her sons married, and a genealogist whom I interviewed in Florence traced the Florentines were marvelous record keepers, so that you can actually go into the archives, and he traced 15 generations and identified her current great granddaughters, and I met them. Their names are Natalia and Irina Guicciardini Strozzi, and from him I learned that her progeny married into some of the most prestigious families in Italy and in Europe. There is even a relative of Sir Winston Churchill in the family tree. And I call them girls because they have this wonderful youthful spirit, but they're both in their 30s. And the family, one of them trained as a ballerina and danced in Russia. And now she's now an actress. And the other went into business and is involved in running the family winery. And both of them have a sort of generic similarity to Mona Lisa because they're Italian. They have dark eyes. They have long brown hair. There's something maybe a little Lisa-esque around the chin. But they said to me, but they have huge smiles. They have Julia Roberts kinds of smiles, you know, just megawatt smiles. And so they said, no, you have to, our father is the one who smiles like the Gioconda. And I wasn't able to meet him at that time, but we were at their winery. And I had left my sunglasses, and I ran back in, and standing before me was this tall, silver-haired man, who was their father. And when he turned around, I saw it. On his lips was the smile, I swear, of the Mona Lisa. And so, I do not think that is conclusive proof, but it was just it just tickled me no end to see that to see the similarity.
In the end, at the end of the book, you talk about what's happened to Mona Lisa.
Yes,
I think that's kind of interesting. All the different avenues you take.
Well, what I think that the painting has had a life of its own, and I did a piece for the Huffington Post called "The 10 Worst Things That Happened to Mona Lisa," and the first thing was that Francis I put her in his bathing salon, which was where he had a steam bath, where his friends came and smoked, and it was a terrible place to put a painting, and that's to try to repair the damage after decades in this humid environment. They put on a really heavy lacquer, and it cracked. And that's why when you see Mona Lisa, there's this kind of net of little wrinkled fissures all across her face. And then she was in the ownership of the French kings, and Louis XIV adored her, and Napoleon later adored her. Both of them put her in the bedroom, their bedrooms. But by the time she made her way to the Louvre, then there were these sort of crazy obsessions. She was stolen, but then she's been mocked. And I think that I have looked at hundreds of images of Mona Lisa, and you see her in a burqa, in a bikini, in a beret, in a Santa cap. You see her on a motorcycle. You name it. And then she's also been reproduced so that there are Mona Lisas made of coffee, of coffee cups with different amounts of milk for the shading, jelly beans, Legos, pixels, yarn, seaweed. And so she has entered our kind of collective unconsciousness, and people want to they want to play with her, but and they can't kind of keep their hands off of her. They just, and it's universal. Everywhere you go on Earth, I've been told, I haven't been, but that in Asia, her face is on beaded curtains, you know, that kind of separate one room from the other. So it's just, she has permeated our universal imagination.
Why do you think that is?
I think it gets back. Well, I think there are two. It's the famous for being famous, you know. Just, but then it also, I think it comes back to this relatedness that she's human to us. She's one of us, and I think part of that is Leonardo's genius, and we obviously enjoy seeing her and manipulating her. And I went to I live in California, and I was in the wine country, and we were at a lovely winery, and they had high scale porta potties, and they were called the Porta Lisa, and there she was on the side of the porta potty.
Oh my
gosh!
What
that has to do with anything in real life is beyond me, but it's just that there's an image, and you want to kind of capture people's imagination and also imply a sort of touch of class. You use Mona Lisa.
And obviously the image is in the public domain.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, and I think the more you see it, and the whole digitalization, you know, has just multiplied that. So that at Stanford Hospital, they have a portrait of Mona Lisa, except she's sneezing into a handkerchief, and it says, you know, cover your mouth. And I think, well, you know, again, people look at it, and it attracts attention, and it gets your message across.
Are you glad? I know you're just delighted in this topic. Was it necessarily something you think, when looking back, if you hadn't had that conversation that particular day, you would have embarked on something like this?
Yes, it's certainly off my, I've spent most of my career as a writing about health and psychology, and then I had this passion for Italian, so I wrote La Bella Lingua, and then that led me to art, and I had loved art history, but I had to go and basically give myself a graduate course in it to do this, so I, it's been when I told my daughter, who's in her 20s, that I was thinking of writing a biography of the real Mona Lisa. She had two reactions, and the first one was she said, "Mom, that's awesome," and then she thought for a little while and she said, "Holy hell!"
Where do you begin?
And I think it was both. It was an awesome adventure, and there were holy hell moments in it. And to come out the other side is just interesting, because I'm finding that that people want to know about her. Mm-hmm. That they're saying, really, she's there, you know, and that again, that humanity, the sense that she lived in a different time, different customs, different rules, different hierarchy, but yet she was a human being, mm-hmm. and we can relate to her at that level.
Diane Hales, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Diane Hales, she's author of Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.